Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us on the Cleveland Public Library's Research Center, dealing with another sports icon today. This is February 10th, 2015, and our guest today is Tom Hamilton, the voice of the Indians since 1990. Welcome to the Cleveland Public Library.
Well, thank you, Dan. It's great to be with you and to all of our viewers and listeners. And, you know, you're somebody that I grew up idolizing, so this is fun for me.
Well, don't look over your shoulder because I shouldn't. You're gaining on me. Anyway, this is now you're entering your 26th season. Is my math correct?
Right.
And you have become not only an icon, you're an institution here in Cleveland sports. How does it feel to be an institution?
Feels like, you know, this might be my funeral, and you're going to preside over the eulogy here.
I've done eulogies.
You know, I don't consider myself any of that. I just consider myself very fortunate that, you know, I haven't used any magical words on the air that could have ended the career before it ever got off the ground. And you know what? We've been really blessed, Dan, and I mean that very seriously, that, you know, my wife and I met in Columbus, and, you know, she was a Pittsburgh girl. I'm from Wisconsin, and when I was fortunate enough to get the Indians job for us, that was the top of the mountain. We didn't have any interest to go anywhere else if we could keep this job. It kept us between both families, and we really thought Cleveland would be a great place to raise our family. At that time, we had one child, 2 months old, and now we have four children. And you know what? It has. It's been just an incredible place to raise a family and to live and to call home. We're the lucky ones.
Tom, when you met your wife, you were in Columbus. Were you doing the Columbus, the minor league baseball team, the AAA?
Yeah.
That was the farm club of the Yankees.
Yeah, it was for many years, the Clippers. Mm-hmm. And they were playing right next to a cemetery at Old Cooper Stadium. Now they've got arguably as good a minor league ballpark as there is downtown, right next to the hockey building in what has become just a tremendous entertainment area in Columbus. And yeah, you know, it's funny, Bucky Dent was our manager, you know, and to get a chance to do AAA for me was huge because I knew it was my only way, if I was ever going to get a major league job, was to get AAA experience. And then your manager is Bucky Dent. And, you know, maybe for the kids today, they don't know who Bucky Dent was, but he was a big name back even in 1990 and had hit that tremendous home run against the Boston Red Sox at Fenway Park.
I covered that game.
Did you really?
I was with the Plain Dealer back in those days.
One of the great, you know, baseball seasons ever when Bucky Dent and the Yankees did that. And he was tremendous to me. You know, you'd say after a game, come on down, let's have a beer. We'll talk baseball. It's a chance for you to even learn more about the game. And that was invaluable, the 3 years that I spent doing AAA baseball in Columbus.
What other sports did you do that might have led you in a different direction?
Well, you know what, Danny? When you start out and you get out of college, I mean, I was at a small station in Shell Lake, Wisconsin, and I literally, you couldn't start any lower than I was. It was a small station. I lived in the basement, actually cellar would be a more proper definition, the cellar of the owner's mother's home. And I'm thinking, you know what, I grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. This is what I gave that up for? But you're doing high school sports. Mm-hmm. And to me, there was nothing better than Friday nights, whether it was a high school football game or high school basketball, and moved on to Watertown and then to Appleton, which is in the Fox Valley and was a great area for high school sports, and covered the Green Bay Packers. And then from there went to Milwaukee and was doing University of Wisconsin football and University of Colorado basketball. And you know, had I gone to Columbus and been, say, the voice of the Buckeyes, I don't know that we would have ever left because we loved the city. And, of course, if you're doing Ohio State, that's about as good as it gets on the college end. So I loved doing them all. I loved football and basketball. But when I got to Columbus, I really wanted to give baseball one more shot and felt like AAA experience was pivotal, and in my case, it was.
Well, another fellow moved from Columbus to St. Louis, Jack Buck.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, Danny, because one of the gentlemen that was up for the Indians job when I got it was Jack Buck's brother, who in that day and age was, I believe, in Evansville. Yeah. And his brother was one of the candidates for the Indians job. And I got a chance to obviously meet Jack and talk with Jack Buck down through the years. And, you know, he was so proud of being from Lakewood. Yeah. And he would tell you all the stories of the streets and being a paper boy and everything growing up in Lakewood. And maybe the funniest man I've ever met. We were in Winter Haven playing the Cardinals in a spring training game. And for me, and meeting those broadcasters, that was a bigger deal for me than meeting any player, because these were the icons that I wanted to someday try to emulate, because I knew I wasn't good enough as an amateur player to play beyond amateur ball. And so this was my chosen field. And, you know, guys like Jack Buck never disappointed you because they were better people than maybe even their reputation was. And we're eating press dining there in Winter Haven. And Jack looked at us as only Jack could, and he tasted the food and goes, this is the kind of food that would start prison riots. And he was such a funny man, and just he was really proud of being from Cleveland. And it made you proud that you were actually doing the Indians games and living in Cleveland.
Well, I remember when the Indians job opened up in 1990, Paul Olden had been doing the games with Herb. And then I'm sure that Herb was delighted when you signed on. You had a good relationship with all of your broadcast partners, I suspect.
Yeah, I really have. I've been very fortunate that way. And as you know, in this industry, there are a lot of broadcasters who have egos that are far bigger than any player you've ever met. And I've been lucky to work with really good people. And guys that would become friends. And so I've not had to deal with some of the horror stories that you heard, even in the Indians broadcast day with guys that, you know, Bob Neal and Jimmy Dudley not liking each other.
Oh, Tom, I did a chapter on those two in my first book, Neal and Dudley, how they hated each other. It is impossible to exaggerate the contempt that they held for each other.
Well, and you know about
that's
writers.
That's part of legend history, the Indians legends.
There were writers that covered the Indians beat that hated each other.
Schneider and Sudik hated each other, yeah.
And it's like, wow, you're with these people in the course of a season more than you are with your own wife.
That's right.
And if you can't get along, it can be a miserable existence. But, you know, it started with Herb, and for me, you know, to get a major league job was a dream come true. Little did I realize how lucky I was that my partner would be her, because he was incredible.
That's right. And then Mike Hegan was a good guy to work with.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think Mike Hegan should be in the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame in the broadcaster's wing. I don't think there's ever been a player that transitioned to the broadcast booth as well as Mike. This is a guy that obviously could be an analyst because of what he knew about the game as a player, but he also did play-by-play on television, play-by-play on radio. I don't think you can name another ex-player that was that good at doing play-by-play in both mediums as well as being as good an analyst as there ever was in the game. And Mike was an even better person. And, you know, the tragedy of it all is that, you know, we lost Mike and Herb way too soon.
That's right. And now you work with Rosie.
You bet. And again,
I have not met, but
you have. Well, you know, don't be afraid to stop up. Yeah. Come to a game once this summer, Danny. You know, I know you're retired, so get down to the park and you can sit in the booth with us. But Rosie's a great guy as well. I've really been lucky.
Okay. I once traveled with the Indians as a baseball writer for the Plain Dealer, and that is a long season.
Yeah, it is.
And back then we had bad teams. Now, when you first signed on, you were covering bad teams. But suddenly you hit the glory trail, the greatest era of Indians baseball since 1948 through the early 50s. Did that affect how much fun your job was? Or, is that a factor in – in how much you enjoy your job.
Yeah, let's face it. Everybody wants to follow a team that's winning, and a team as dynamic as that was, I don't think even at the time I realized how lucky I was.
However, sometimes those good teams are tough to work with.
They can be, but, you know, in my situation, because guys had known me from really the time, you know, I was lucky in that my first year was 1990, and that was Sandy Alomar's first year, and he became the American League Rookie of the Year. And then in the succeeding years, you know, we were bringing up guys like Albert Bell and Jim Thome and Manny Ramirez and Charlie Nagy and traded for Paul Sorrento and traded for Carlos Baerga and Omar Vizquel and Kenny Lofton. And so we were all kind of young at the same time. I was still older than they were, but not that much older. Now, you know, I could be some of these players' grandpa. But, you know, so you had a lot more in common with those guys, and I think they trusted me because I'd been there with them when they weren't very good and the team was not very good. And so, you know, you kind of felt like you grew up with them and you went from, you know, experiencing, you know, the agony of defeat to the thrill of victory. And it really was. It was a tremendous period of time. And even a guy like Albert Bell, I've golfed a couple of times with Albert Bell. And the only guy throwing clubs, Danny, was me, you know. So, you know, you saw a different side of Albert out on a golf course and away from the field. And because they trusted you, then they let you into their world, so to speak. And, you know, I was just very fortunate. Everybody enjoys covering it. But, you know, the greatest advice I ever got from Herb was, as you mentioned, my first year was 90. And, you know, 91 was the worst season in Indians history. 92 and 93 were not good years. Again, those were first 4 years. We were a well below 500 club. And Herb always used to say, hey, team's record never impacts tonight's broadcast. You don't bring that kind of an attitude into the booth because tonight's game is what's the most important thing. And you've got people counting on you at home that maybe tonight's game is the highlight of their day. And you can't be worried about what the team's record is. You owe these people the best that you've got.
Did you have a special relationship with any players over the years?
Oh, I think you do, you know, more so than Danny. And again, it's because of the age difference, you know. Like I say, in those days, you were a few years older than the players. But, you know, the longer I've been in this now, you know, again, I've done the Indians for 25 years. Well, we've got guys that aren't even 25 years old that are on our ball club. So they do look at you like, you know, well, you're as old as my dad. And so I think that relationship changes. And I think you also realize long you're in the game that, you know, players are going to come and go. And, you know, it's really not my job to try to be buddy-buddy with them. I want them to like me and respect me, but, you know, I'm not going out with them. You know, I don't need to be doing that. And so, but, yeah, I mean, you had special relationships, and you still do to this day, kind of with those guys you were there with in the beginning, Sandy Alomar, Charlie Nagy, Jim Thome, Omar, even Kenny and Carlos, because it was such a great period in everyone's life that I think they look at you in the same light that, you know what, we like you because it was a good time for us too. So, you know, I think those relationships have endured, and, you know, it's not like we're exchanging, you know, Christmas cards and all of that, but it's always fun when you get together with them because, you know, all it is really for the most part, Danny, are great memories from back then.
Well, when I was covering, there were only two of us in the same boat, me and the guy from the Cleveland Press.
Mm-hmm.
You needed more than two guys. So, frankly, a lot of the players and the manager, Jeff Torborg, and the coaches became great friends. And out on the road, we once went on a 19-day trip to the West Coast. My God. And this was like the Battle of the Bulge. You know? You needed somebody with you. And so, thank God, I had a great relationship with the coaches and with the manager, Jeff Torborg, a great, great guy. And several of the players were good old friends. Dwayne Kuiper and Manning and Hargrove. We traded for Hargrove in the middle of one of those seasons. And so they were good guys. Good guys to travel with.
Yeah, and we still have that. I think the one thing the Indians front office has done almost the entire time I've been here, starting with Hank, then with John Hart and Danny O'Dowd, then Mark Shapiro, now Chris Antonetti. Character means something to these people. When they make a trade or they draft, you know, that's part of the equation. It's not just about how good a player is he. It's also about what kind of a person are we getting here. And so for the most part, we've had really good people in addition to good players. But I also think, Danny, you know, we've talked about it, times have really changed. You know, you think back into the mid-90s and whatnot, well, nobody had cell phones. You know, if they did, the cell phone was the size of your shoe, you know, and nobody had the ability to take photos anywhere you went. And so I think society has changed everything now, and players have to be a lot more careful and a little more suspicious because you just, you know, you're always afraid of getting exploited.
That's right. As we've talked about this on other occasions, you have no privacy because wherever you go, in a bar, in a restaurant, we're in the ball, just walking through the ballpark. People want to take their pictures with you, and you never know what's going to happen to that picture.
It's too bad, you know.
Yeah, it is.
And it's how our society has changed.
There was another change, which I don't know if you've noticed it, but when I was a traveling baseball writer back in the 70s, I was making almost as much as a utility infielder.
Yeah.
And so if we wound up after a game, I'd buy a round, he'd buy a round. Today, there is such an economic gap between even a well-paid broadcaster such as yourself and a Major League Baseball player. My God, it's the world of difference. And so that's another thing that separates us. There's an economic barrier there, I think.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, and again, it's not been that long ago, but I think it would be hard today for a player to realize that not that long ago, players worked in the off season.
That's right.
Because their salary, as you mentioned, wasn't a whole lot different than the guy living down the block who maybe was a mailman or a school teacher or whatever it might be. But, yeah, the economy and the money that is being made has really put a divide, unfortunately, between players. And, again, I'm sometimes very sympathetic toward the players, too, because people know they're making money, and people are always trying to get their hands on other people's money.
You know, Dino Lucarelli tells a wonderful story when he was once the PR guy for the Indians back in the early 70s. And we had a utility infielder, outfielder named John Lowenstein.
Oh, yeah.
You may have crossed paths with him over the years.
Oh, my gosh, especially in Baltimore. Yeah.
Yes, uh-huh. And so one summer, he got a job at the Cleveland Zoo shoveling manure. when the Indians were at home and they had a night game, he and one of the pitchers, they had working what minimum wage at the zoo.
Yeah.
They would the mornings of those night games, they would shovel the manure. One day, John Lowenstein was supposed to be the speaker at the Wahoo Club luncheon. Back then, that was the Indians Booster Club, the Wahoo Club. They would hold monthly get-togethers, luncheon. And Gabe Paul and a couple of players would speak to the group and take questions. One of those meetings at a downtown hotel, Lowenstein was supposed to be the speaker. He didn't show up. Gabe Paul arrives back at his office that afternoon screaming at Dino Lucarelli, "Where was Lowenstein? Find out why Lowenstein wasn't there." And Dino said, "Well, I know why he wasn't there, because he's got a job at the zoo shoveling manure." So Gabe almost had the big heart attack right then.
Oh, can you imagine?
We've seen so many changes. The ballparks. How did you, when you came up here to work in the Cleveland Stadium, you didn't know the difference. You thought that was the way an old ballpark was, right?
Well,
and
yeah.
I'm going to ask you, the working in the new one.
And you know what? Because it was my first major league job, to me, that was Camelot. Uh-huh. You know, that was my castle to go to work at. And, you know, we had a great vantage point as far as calling a game. You were much lower in those days than you are now. Hey, if the game was bad, and a lot of them were, you could look out at Lake Erie and look at the boats and, you know, distract yourself a little bit. But,
back in those days, you had a lot.
You did that a lot, But I really enjoyed the old place. Now, it was not a good facility, and it was way too big for baseball. So I think the startling aspect of moving into a new ballpark was even greater because of what you had come from.
How about some of the people that you would work with on a daily basis, the managers? How about your relationship?
You know what? I've been, again, really lucky in that, you know, starting with John McNamara, I've had really good people to be around. And Johnny Mack was another guy. You know, this is John McNamara who, when the Indians hired him, was still scarred from what had happened in the 1986 World Series with Boston and the New York Mets. And Boston never forgave him for not winning that World Series and closing it out in Game 6. And Johnny Mack was much like Bucky Dent. You come down here after games, we'll talk baseball. This is how you educate yourself further. Hank Peters was that way as the general manager. And then, you know, from John, it went to Grover. And if you can't get along with Grover, then you better look in the mirror. And I don't think Mike ever got enough credit for what an outstanding manager he was and the job he did with, yes, very talented teams, but teams that he didn't have to be the smartest guy in the room. He knew he had talent, so he didn't have to be Bobby Valentine and make it all about him. He was Mike Hargrove and said, the players play. Let them go play, and they thrived under that leadership. And then, you know, following Mike, you know, Charlie Manuel, who you're not going to meet a better person or a more delightful human being than Charlie. And, you know, from there, from Charlie, it went, you know, to Eric Wedge. And, you know, Eric was a polar opposite of Charlie. But I really liked Eric because I always felt like Eric was a man's man. And he was a guy that everything was black and white. There was no gray area. You know, there was right and wrong, nothing in between. And that was refreshing. Manny Acta, you know, followed Eric. And while, you know, he was not very successful as a manager, as a human being, you're not going to meet a better guy. And then the guy we have now, Tito. I mean, Tito has us all spoiled that I think the day Tito retires, a lot of us in the Indians will want to retire because how does it get better than working with him?
Yeah, that, you call him Tito and sometimes you call him Terry.
Yeah.
What is going on with his name?
Well, you know,
I'm going to have to get him down here someday.
He goes by both. And honestly, Dan, I've always called him Terry, but now in the 2 years he's been with us, I'm in the minority. When you're out on a field and the other manager or players come up from the other team, it's Tito. Nobody calls him Terry.
And his own players call him Tito.
Yeah, exactly.
And now general managers, John Hart. First of all, we dealt with Hank Peters.
Right, who never got, again, proper recognition or credit.
One of the great gentlemen of the game.
He's the guy that had the plan. Mm-hmm. You know, trade Joe Carter, get Sandy Alomar, get Carlos Baerga, get rid of all these older players. We're not going to win for a while. We're going to do it the right way through the farm system like he did in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And then when we get good, we'll supplement that young talent with some proven veterans, Eddie Murray, Oral Hershiser, Dennis Martinez, Tony Pena. Hank Peters had the vision, but more importantly, Dan, he had the guts to stick with it even when times were going bad. And he, of course, brought along John Hart and Danny O'Dowd, who then in turn brought in Mark Shapiro. And so, you know, I think all those guys really speak for themselves. John Hart, arguably the most successful GM the Indians have ever had. Danny O'Dowd was every bit as important to this organization as John was, and then went on and had a tremendous run with Colorado, got them to the World Series. I thought Mark Shapiro did a terrific job considering what he was given. When John left, he knew the end was near as far as this club and that the farm system wasn't very good and there would be lean years. And Mark took that on and rebuilt the club to get it back to where it should have been in the playoffs in 2005. And then, you know, we get there in 07. And then, you know, he hands it over to Chris Antonetti. And, you know, Chris got us to the playoffs 2 years ago. And now we we have a chance to have some sustained success, Danny, for I want to say we've got a 3 to 5 year window here. We haven't had that in a long time.
How about the Dolan family running the Indians?
Well, you can't work for better people. That's and again, right. I've worked for two ownership groups, and they've both been top shelf. You know, Dick and Dave Jacobs were outstanding, and again, history has recorded how important they were. They saved baseball in Cleveland, Danny. You know, Herb would tell me all these stories of ownership never having any money, people wondering if payroll was going to be met, if players would be declared free agents because their paychecks bounced. It was when Dick and Dave Jacobs bought the club that they had the money and the wherewithal to do it the right way and then got Jacobs Field built. And then, you know, the Dolans took over, and you cannot work for finer human beings than Larry and Eva Dolan and now, you know, Paul and his family. There's a reason why people in the organization don't leave the Indians, and it's because of the kind of ownership and the kind of people we work for.
So, and how about you? How much longer are you going to work?
Well,
Is this really work?
No, and I've said that. I don't ever want to get a real job again. And how many of us wake up in the morning and can't wait to go to work? And again, I've been really lucky and really blessed. And, you know, I had a father who, when he sold the farm, you know, then worked at a printing shop and hated every minute of it. But you do what you have to do to make ends meet and, you know, put, you know, food on the table and a roof over your family's heads. And a lot of people do that, you know. They're working in jobs they hate, but it's a way to make a living and provide for their family. And kudos to them, because I'm doing something I always dreamed about doing, and that dream became a reality. So, you know, the key is not to say some of those words on the air. Hope the broadcast booth isn't mic'd during commercial breaks, and I'll do it as long as I enjoy it.
And you've got two sons and two daughters.
Yep, four children.
One son is playing pro baseball.
Yep, well, Nick is now done playing. He ended up playing 3 years in the minor leagues, and now he wants to get into the front office. And so he's an area scout this year for the Philadelphia Phillies. And he was told by a general manager from another organization, Nick, go to scout school, learn how to scout and player evaluate so that when you get into the front office, you're a guy that brings your own set of eyes to the table, and you're not relying on everybody else's opinion or relying on analytics. You'll have a feel for it. And I thought it was great advice. So he's really enjoying that. He'd like to be playing like we all would, but he had his time and really enjoyed it. And I have another son now who's a freshman catcher playing for Kent State. So we get to do that again, and two girls that are doing very well in school as well.
Great. You really grew up on a dairy farm?
Yeah, until eighth grade. Moved to the metropolis of Waterloo, which was 1,400 people at the time. So for me, that was a big deal. I mean, if you grow up on a farm, there's nobody around you. And, you know, the view from behind a cow never changes. And
did you really milk a cow?
Well, you know what? I was too young. My dad had quit milking when I was probably third or fourth grade. So I'd be down at the barn thinking I was helping, mainly trying to stay out of the way and not get kicked by a cow. But, you know, I did help as far as, you know, baling hay and doing all of that. And then would continue to help friends that lived on the farm when I was in high school once we moved to the metropolis of Waterloo, Wisconsin.
Growing up on a farm, did you ever witness the birth of a cow, or did you buy grown?
Again, I was a little young for that. You know, I got to witness, you know, how we ate chicken since we grew them, and we'd help catch the chicken, then watch my dad take the axe to the chicken's neck, and that was always entertaining because you get to watch the head bounce around, detached from the body for a while. And
that's wonderful.
Yeah, you know, I just think that visualization will help anybody sitting down to a bucket of fried chicken tonight.
Oh, no.
But, you know, and then, you know, we raised, raised dairy cows and pigs and chicken. It was a typical Wisconsin dairy farm, milked about 50 cows, 150 acres. But my dad got out of it because he saw what was coming. And what was coming was you were now going to have to get, you know, a much better barn, and it would all become hydraulic. So there was going to be a lot of money that had to be invested. And as you know now, nobody has 150-acre farms and milks anymore. There are all these mammoth milking parlors, and you're milking cows three times a day, and you might be milking 900 cows a day. So the days of what my dad did are long gone.
Pleasant days for you on the farm, though.
Did you know what?
Miss those days.
I appreciate it more now, Danny. When you're young, you're like, "Why am I stuck on this farm? The only people I get to play with are my brothers and sister, and we're fighting all the time." So you missed being able to run to a park and play with your friends, and you know, I got to do that once we moved to town in eighth grade. And but you know what it did do, and you don't realize it at the time. It forced you to be creative. It forced you to come up with your own games. You might be playing by yourself because you and your next in line sibling were not speaking to each other, and you know, so and believe it or not, I'd play these games, whether it's basketball, baseball, or football, by myself out in the yard, broadcasting them to myself, not even thinking about it at the time. And so I think in some ways that helped you. And I also think it gives you a greater appreciation for when you get these jobs of maybe where you came from and how lucky you are and how you'll never take it for granted. So I have much greater appreciation now for where I grew up than I probably did at the time.
Well, then as a kid, if you were broadcasting these games, you had to have heard broadcasters.
Right, in those days.
Back in those days, you had radio back
then? Oh, yeah, we did, you know, on black and white television. My first game that I ever saw, people will hate this, but hey, I don't care. I'm a Packers fan because that's what I grew up with. The first game I saw on color television was the Green Bay Packers defeating the Cleveland Browns in the 1965 NFL Championship game. And on a muddy field in Green Bay where the Packers
– terrible snowstorm.
Yes, they was. But no problems for Jim Taylor and Paul Hornung. The guy that had trouble was Jim Brown. So Packers won that game, first game I ever saw on color television. But, yeah, in those days, the Milwaukee Braves, you know, were still in Milwaukee. And those were – they were teams of my youth that were very similar to the Indians teams of the 90s. Where they had some of the greatest offensive players in the game. Hank Aaron, Eddie Matthews, Rico Cardi, Felipe Alou, you know, Mac Jones, Joe Adcock, Del Crandall, Joe Torre. I can go down the line. Warren Spahn and Lou Burdett. You know, you had a lot of Hall of Famers. They were really good teams, and Earl Gillespie was doing the games. And I just thought, can you imagine a greater way to make a living? You're going to all these unbelievable cities and seeing these guys and these stadiums. And luckily enough for me, later in life I would do University of Wisconsin football with Earl Gillespie, a guy I grew up listening to when I was a little guy on the farm doing Milwaukee Braves games. And it's still one of the greatest thrills of my life that I got to work with him.
How did he influence your broadcasting style, and how did any other – what influences did you have?
I think you're always influenced by who you listen to and who you grew up listening to. And, you know, we were really lucky back then. We had Earl Gillespie doing the Braves. And then when Earl left, Merle Harmon and Bob Uecker did the Brewers. And Merle Harmon's another guy that, you know, he did the New York Jets when Joe Namath won the Super Bowl. And Merle Harmon's one of the great broadcasters that never has maybe been truly recognized, and we know how good Yuki is. You know, the Packer games in those days were being done by Gary Bender, who would later go on to be the lead broadcaster for CBS, doing the Final Four and NFL football. So we had some really top-notch broadcasters in Wisconsin. Eddie Doucette was doing the Milwaukee Braves or Milwaukee Bucks. And he's the guy that came up with all of these basketball terms I'd never heard of. And a ball in the lane, you were in the toaster. And rainbow jump shot. And, you know, he was so far ahead of his time. So I think, you know, you're always influenced. And you're always listening to people, maybe stealing this from that person and something else from that.
Why do I remember Ray Scott as the voice?
And Ray Scott was our Packer broadcaster on Sundays on the CBS network. And ironically enough, again, you know, it's funny how your paths cross. I was up for the job to become the voice of Nebraska Cornhusker football.
Really?
and he got it, and I didn't. Wow. And at that point, Ray was at the tail end of his career, and I'm like, gosh, I really used to like that guy, but he got my job. But and he was phenomenal in that. He was so simplistic. But yes. I didn't really get much from Ray Scott because he was television. Uh-huh. And for me, the people I wanted to emulate and listen to were all on the radio because, again, not to be snobbish, but radio is the true play-by-play medium. And I still do, you know, Big Ten basketball on television. And while I enjoy it, you're not doing play-by-play. The camera does play-by-play on television, and you're just kind of filling in. Whereas radio, you truly are the eyes of the listener, and to me it's much more fun.
Well, you've certainly made it fun for the Cleveland baseball listeners.
Oh, thank you, Danny.
I'll tell you, Tom. 25 years. Herb might have had a couple extra years, but that before you're done, you will be the longest tenured baseball broadcaster in Cleveland history. Boy, that's really something to look forward to.
You know, and you don't even think of that again because I know how lucky and fortunate we are and how blessed we've been. And, you know, hey, I could get fired tomorrow. You know, none of us is above that. And I think that's when you get in trouble if you think you're so good you can't be replaced because we're all replaceable. And, you know, the bottom line is people want to listen to Indians baseball. And, you know, hopefully I can keep doing it if the Indians think that's okay.
Oh, I'm sure that they're going to think that's okay for quite a while. Tom Hamilton, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Danny. My pleasure.
With the Cleveland Public Library. Thanks for joining us, everybody.